This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Thanks for joining us on this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego. And this is a debate about the future of the 79th Assembly District, at least who will represent it in Sacramento. This week, I hosted a discussion with the five candidates looking to replace Shirley Weber. She represented the district for almost a decade and was arguably one of the most influential lawmakers at the state capitol. She was recently appointed, of course, to be Secretary of State by Governor Gavin Newsom. So now we have a special election to fill her seat. The primary vote is April 6th. The candidates you're going to hear are Marco Contreras. He's a small business owner. Aramique Glass Blake. She's a restorative justice consultant. Leticia Munguia. She's a community organizer. Shane Suzanne Parmalee is a public school teacher. And Akilah Weber is a doctor and a member of the city council in La Mesa. We're going to start it off here with schools. This was the first part of what were essentially two parts of the debate. Part two was about criminal justice and criminal justice reform. So let's jump in on the school debate. I asked the candidates what they would say about a current bill that aims to get schools open, that offers money if they can get open, but also is a little bit slower than what the governor had in mind. What would they do to incentivize reopening, or what are they waiting to see before they support it? I started with the teacher who's running, Shane Suzanne Parmalee.
SB 86 is greatly improvement. It's a big improvement over what the governor came out with in December. I think he was scrambling, chasing his tail with the recall, and it backfired, and now more people are upset with him. There was another bill that came out that also was a little problematic. They clearly had not talked with teachers, and it was interesting because it was kind of like, hey, did you know some of our friends in the legislature just came out with this bill and they're also starting with the hard open date, like regardless of all the other indicators when it comes to safety. So SB 86 is definitely an improvement. I'm supporting it. My understanding is there is pushback from some other people at the state level and there might be some convincing required, but that's really unfortunate because I don't want to teach in my kitchen. I also don't want to die or kill anybody in my house. The communities that have been hardest hit by COVID, if you poll them, they do not want to return to in-person learning. And at this point, I know a lot of people who've had a family member die from COVID, and certain neighborhoods that have been completely devastated where multiple people on the same block have died from COVID. So I think the SB 86 is a good plan. It's looking good. I think the timeline is good. I think the prioritizing of our most at-risk kids, super, like that's why I went into education. That's been my focus. So it's definitely headed in the right direction. But yes, we need to bring the community transmission down out of the purple tier. It needs to be in red. We're currently seven times over purple. We're not even at purple. We're seven times over purple.
So
and we need the vaccines.
There's a lot of announcements. Encinitas, San Diego Unified said they want to come back April 12th. Are you saying that even that's too soon for you?
So, no, they didn't say they're opening the entire school April 12th. It was interesting to watch that get put out in the media. Both the union and the school district was like, that's interesting because we haven't, nothing's finalized. So it's fascinating when the media is always ahead of everybody saying stuff and then the district and the union have to come back afterwards and try to clarify.
Okay. Interesting. So we shouldn't get our hopes up.
I think we just need to actually look and see what the plan is, as opposed to listening to a newscaster who's just telling you stuff.
Well, I think the source of that was Richard Barrera, the school trustee, said that we would be able, if we got into the red tier and if they had time to vaccine. Is that the conditions you would think
yes.
would be enough?
And the mitigation. So it's the three tiers, right? The three pillars. It needs to be brought down to red. We need to have vaccines, and we don't want to sit in a room that's going to circulate air that gets everybody sick. So, I mean, that's just science. That is science-based, not political whim-based reopening school plan.
Akilah Weber, if you were in the legislature, what would you be saying about this situation?
Well, you know, Scott, I look at this from not only a medical standpoint, but from the fact that I'm a parent of two young boys in elementary school. And we've, you know, had the challenges of dealing with at-home learning while trying to work and do a lot of other things. But, you know, if I were in the legislative body, there would be a lot of things that would have happened very differently during this whole pandemic, to be quite honest with you. You know, I do not agree with returning to school for those larger school districts unless you either have vaccines or you have mass testing. And the reality is that we should have been focusing as a state on what we said we were going to do when we first went out in March, which was to make sure that there was mass testing. You know, I have colleagues whose kids are in colleges in New York and Boston, and they haven't skipped a beat because they have mass testing. They test their students every 3 days. For a long time, while our pandemic was raging, as a physician, I had to go in and get tested every single week. And so this is something that needs to happen. You either have mass testing or you have vaccinations. But if you don't have either one, then it's really not safe to return. And I understand it. I mean, you know, I'm a parent, I've got kids. You heard him doing his homework right before we started this. And, you know, they've been out of sports for the last year. It is hard. It has been very, very hard on everybody, and especially our kids. But we do not want to sacrifice their health. And what we're seeing with studies from a medical standpoint is that there are some long-term side effects that we're seeing now with kids getting COVID as well. But what we should have done, if I were in the legislative body at this point or during this COVID pandemic, I definitely would have kept on the governor about working with other companies here in California to make sure that we produced mass testing that was accurate and rapid. That's what we needed.
Leticia Munguia, I'm going to turn to you. You know, were you in the legislature during this discussion? What would you be saying about how urgently we would need to get kids into classes in person and how that debate has gone and how the governor's led on it?
I think for me, the most important piece is a safe return. Safe return. Our communities have been most greatly impacted in 2020. There's a lot that we've all gone through, right, with COVID, the pandemic. Also, there's been another level of social awareness where we focus on issues of equity and access. And I actually truly believe that as a legislator in Sacramento, it's absolutely critical that the lives of our students, our parents, our teachers, and our school workers are like at the priority. And it's all about being able to have access, being able to have access to testing, to the vaccine, and also being able to make sure that our facilities, our schools are equipped. District to district, there's a great variance of resources and services. I mean, you mentioned the Assembly District 79 and what the districts that are composed. And I will tell you, the composition of the school districts really vary on how much resources are being put in to ventilation. As you have covered for the last 8 to 10 months, issues of ventilation, the 6 feet distance, being able to ensure that there is safety in rapid sanitation is absolutely critical to keep our families, our folks safe. Ultimately, until we're able to penetrate with the vaccine and making sure that our students and our learning communities have access and that we are dealing, as was mentioned earlier, we have students and parents and staff that are now in a process called long haulers that are actually dealing with the side effects of having had COVID and they're currently recovering from it. So there's a lot of resources that I believe need to be dedicated from Sacramento to ensure that our local schools and our students and our families have wraparound services. I think it was mentioned earlier, mental health and making sure we transcend after returning that we address issues locally with some support, clinical support services, because our students and our staff should have that available as everybody deals with the not just the medical, but the clinical application of going through COVID.
This basic framework of the vaccine being available, the conditions going down to the spread of the red tier, and the ventilation, thank you for bringing that up. What I wouldn't give for ventilation to have been as big a deal as washing hands. But those things, would that be enough to open in-person education in your point of view?
I think that those were to be the base for my analysis to chart out a course of reopening.
Got it. Marco Contreras, I'd like to hear your perspective on this. You made a point of saying we need to get things open and go back. I imagine you feel that it's more urgent than what has happened so far.
Yeah, my approach would be the exact opposite. I think we have to follow the science. The CDC director, Rochelle Walensky, came out February 3rd saying, quote, "There's increasing data to suggest that schools can safely reopen," end quote. She also said that teachers could go back to school without the vaccine. So that's just following the signs. Now, I would support providing the vaccine to the teachers ASAP, like 6 months ago or 4 months ago, whenever they came out. Now, I think we have to follow the science, but also look at the models. For example, private schools have been open for how long now? A lot of our kids' friends have been going to school for months now, and they're completely fine. Places like Florida, for example, they've been open since May, September fully open, and they're completely fine. In fact, they have lower cases per capita in Florida and fully open since September, Dakotas, Georgia. So I would have said, hey, let's open up because of the harmful disparities that we're seeing. The evidence shows that the schools being closed affects people of the lower tier in socioeconomics. So I would have said, hey, let's open. And we've seen that it's worked.
Is there something about the bill SB 86? Would you have supported the governor's version of it to push them to open in February? Or is the whole framework of money to push them to open something you would have rejected?
I think I would have said, hey, first of all, let's open up. But I've seen that the bill is incomplete. I think we need a little more funding, and we do need to get the vaccines for the teachers.
Okay. Aramique Glass-Blake, were you a legislator as well having this conversation? What do you think about those timelines and that framework for in-person learning?
You know, there's something I always say. When young people are in a space, their voices should be the loudest voices in the room. And what I mean by that, I have a sister who I share responsibility with my father since I lost my mom. And my sister's 14 and her school is currently partially open. And she chose not to go back to class. And she did that because she did not want to put someone like myself, my grandparents, in harm's way. And so I asked, you know, what would it look like? And she said, bring me a plan. You know, what do you think? And I talked about how we needed to not just increase the ventilation rate and upgrade our filter system and have portable air cleaners, but we need to make sure that before any teacher goes back on campus, they are vaccinated. We need to make sure that our teachers are protected, our students are protected. And we also need to make sure that they have PPE. We also need to make sure that these things, these resources are provided on an equitable level. Who needs what now? Who doesn't have these filters? A lot of these private schools and these other things that have these privileges have access. And we're able to get things that many of our public schools were not able to get, right? And so we need to make sure that we have all of these things in place. The reason why we're still in this situation is because people jumped the gun. I want to make sure that our schools reopen, right? I know what mentally this is doing to our young people and really mentally what it's doing to our parents. But we need to make sure we do things in decency and in order and implement it on an equitable level.
I'm curious what you all would think about actually mandating that teachers and students, or that school staff and students, be required to have the vaccine. The legislature has done that for other vaccines. would you all, and we can just go through each of you quickly, would you support mandating this vaccine for educators and students? Dr. Weber?
Well, first, you can't mandate it for students because the vaccine isn't approved for people under the age of 16. So, you know, as far as mandating it for adults, I don't necessarily think we need to mandate it, but if someone chooses not to get it, then they definitely need to make sure that they're continuing to mask and do the social distancing and wear the face shield until we are completely out of this pandemic. But I would not advocate mandating that someone get this vaccine.
Leticia Munguia?
No, I would not mandate it, Scott. I think that it's an individual choice. And I also know that there might be some existing health concerns that would help, you know, the conversation needs to happen between the physician and the recipient of the vaccine. So my answer is no at this time.
Shane?
Yeah, no, you know. And I think if you tried to mandate it, you just waste a bunch of time and energy arguing with people about it. The reality is some people are going to get it, some people aren't. Most people want it. And I do have, I have friends who they cannot take vaccines. They've had allergic reactions. And so they're hoping everyone else gets them. I think, you know, I'm a parent too, with kids in high school. And I think the trickier question is, if you send your kids back to school, are you going to be able to find out if you're, if the teacher has had the vaccine? But then on top of that, we don't know yet whether or not the vaccines prevent from somebody from transmitting it. So there's like, when we talk about science, and that would be like the actual research from researchers, not, you know, politically appointed people who are coming up with policy that benefits certain people more than others. The scientists are even saying, we don't know what this is going to look like in a couple of months. So to circle back on my earlier comment, like, subject to change when the new variants start hitting and we find out the vaccine works or it doesn't work or whatever else is happening. And I think we need to be fluid with this situation as opposed to just giving up and reopening everything. And something to look at is check outside the United States how it's going in other countries too, because at some point it's not going to be a pandemic. It's going to be an endemic with certain countries who are not doing a good job handling it.
Yeah. Thank you. Marco, would you mandate the vaccine?
No, absolutely not. I think it goes against the very foundations of our country. We're a country of freedom. I think it's up to the individual to choose. And yeah.
Thank you. Aramie?
No, definitely not. And I think in communities of color, there's a lot of distrust with our healthcare system and with vaccinations. And I think we need a lot of education and a lot of reassurance and a lot more information. I would not mandate it, but I would definitely encourage it.
Let's move on to some other issues with public education. One of the things that Shirley Weber pushed pretty hard, unsuccessfully several times, was an effort to make school districts more accountable for the money that they were receiving for English language learners, foster students, or areas with high concentrations of poverty. The government and the governor and the state legislature did make more money available for those areas, and she wanted to put some controls and accountability mechanisms in place for that. And she had a lot of trouble doing that. I'm curious for any of your perspective on why she did have trouble getting that through and what whether that was a priority she should have had more support with. And I guess I would go with you, Akilah Weber. You watched that, I'm sure, a little bit. What's your takeaway from it?
Well, you know, whenever you talk about equity and equality, you really have to understand what the difference is. And so, you know, if I have 20 apples and I'm going to come and give them to, you know, five people, then everyone gets four. That's equal. I've given them out equally. However, one or two people may have already had four apples already. And so those people are already at an advantage. And now I've given them more of an advantage. And so what equity does is it recognizes that, you know, different people, different communities, have different circumstances, and you allocate your resources accordingly so that you come to an equal outcome. And so that's what she was always referring to. And there is something called local control funding formula, and that the purpose of that really was to allocate resources equitably. However, there was an audit done that showed that that wasn't happening. And so, you know, if you're really concerned about children and making sure that every child in California has an excellent quality education, has the foundation to go on and do whatever he or she decides to do, whether it's a trade or a two-year university, a four-year university, graduate school, then you really need to make sure that regardless of where your zip code is or the zip code of where your school is, that you are getting that same quality standard education, and whatever your community needs, whatever you need as a child and a student, you are getting that. And unfortunately, that's not happening in many, many, many of our school districts. And so that's really what she was fighting for, to make sure that we had equity in order to reach equality. And, you know, and I'm very hopeful that that is something that we will continue to work on in the future. But in order to do that, we do need to have oversight to make sure that the money is going where it's supposed to go. And not only do we need oversight, but we also need to make sure that the interventions that are being put in place are actually working. So if we're saying that we're putting more money in this district to reduce the student teacher ratio, that we're going back and we're seeing an improvement in some of the interventions that we've used. So so that, you know, that's how I feel. Every student here that is in California public school should get a quality education, regardless of where they live.
Leticia Munguia, what is your take on how that money's been spent and how it might be better held accountable?
So the issue regarding the local control funding formula, it's a huge improvement than what we've had before. So I will tell you that from a application of the local control funding formula, the different categories, the intent behind the application of LCFF was to ensure that our communities of higher needs, like foster children, English as a second language, homeless population, also the folks that are dependent on a lunch, a breakfast and a lunch and a snack in the classroom, were able to receive additional resources, similar to creating a level of equity of access. I will tell you that the local control funding formula has delivered measurable gains. However, the next level of review should be components that are created in a new legislation that addresses how the resources and funding is being utilized through some level of reporting, through some level of transparency of resource use, as well as ensuring that we could actually see the measurable improvements. In some instances, the districts that have what we usually have referred to as like LCFF coordinators, there's been measurable reports that demonstrate the great work that our districts are doing in serving the needs of the higher need population. So generally, I think it's done good work, but I believe we need to take it to another level of implementation in the year to come.
Got it. Cool. Thank you. Aramik?
Yeah, I really agree with a lot of what Leticia said. And I really believe that many times, I work with many schools throughout San Diego County and within the 79th. And many times within our educational system and in other policies that we get passed, we pass these policies, but we don't make sure that they're implemented properly. And then the reason why we even created the policy in the first place does not play out well, particularly in communities of color and diverse communities, right? And so we see, you're going to hear all night long and in every conversation we have, equity, 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 because in the 79th, we have had a huge issue with inequities, right? And that's what we're constantly dealing with. And so like Leticia said, we have to have oversight, we have to have transparency, and we have to be able to measure how these policies are actually directly impacting our schools and communities.
Shane?
This is a big part of why I'm running. 40% of the general fund goes towards public education. So LCFF was a mixed bag. The intent behind it was to cut categorical strings and give districts more flexibility with how they spend their money, so they weren't, you know, having to buy new books when they didn't need to buy new books, things like that. But it was a double-edged sword because it did cut the categorical streams. So the money didn't have to actually follow the students onto the school sites anymore. And I have a history of showing up at school board meetings and, you know, calling out the district on the inequity of their funding and how they reallocated resources once we switched to LCFF. The LCAP, I was a parent in the district at the time when we switched, and the LCAP was a joke. All three of my kids have gone to San Diego Unified. The LCAP process was an absolute joke. It was a, here, we're going to check the compliance box. The parents like agreed with stuff we were already going to do. There was no opportunity for input. And that's when we first switched. My kids went to Boone. I choiced into a failing school, Boone Elementary, because it was an excellent school. When we're talking about accountability, I have a question though, like what's the definition? Is it that the individual child is making progress and making gains? Or is it that we're pitting the kids against each other in a testing, in standardized testing, which is designed to make sure a third of students are always failing? It is actually impossible for all students to achieve grade level on a standardized test just by the way they're designed. And I have a background in assessment. So that was a great talking point that was kind of co-opted by like George Bush and the people who wanted to privatize public education. And I was in for it, like the soft bigotry of low expectations. This was my driving force when I first came into teaching 20 years ago. But the reality is, testing was a way to divert dollars from the classroom and into corporate coffers where we're providing all this. Now you have to pay for the test. You have to pay for the test prep. You have to pay for all of this remediation. When the reality is like, let's look at the child. You know, a child who went to preschool and has two parents who went to college is showing up in kindergarten with a different skill set than a child who is growing up in a family that does not speak English fluently. So, and then you're comparing those kids against each other and saying the kid who comes from the English learner family is a failure and making them hate school all through elementary school. It strips out the art, it strips out the fun, all of the whole focus. And that was a real frustration for me as a parent at Boone. The focus was on raising test scores the entire time. To go to the assembly and hear that the reason why we're doing a readathon, which I loved readathons, I'm a nerd. The reason why we read books is to raise our test scores. It's like, no, that's not why we read books. We read books to like gain knowledge. So LCFF has been super problematic. The money is not following directly to the kids. The English learner program got in trouble. I was an English learner support teacher for 8 years. It was gutted. San Diego Unified got in trouble at the federal level and at the state level. And now they've been scrambling to try and reclassify kids. We need to make sure that that money actually shows up on the campuses and provides extra adults to provide services and pay attention to those kids.
Marco.
Yeah, no, I think Shirley Weber did a lot for the community. And I loved something she said when discussing K-12 reform, quote, if we're not about the business of improving the lives of children, then what the hell are we doing? End quote. And I think that's what we should do, fight for our children. I love how she evolved in her point of view of school choice. At first, she was opposed to charter schools. And then after she saw the results of a Gumper school, she was so for it. And she said, I went up against a teachers union because I'm an advocate for quality education and I'm not easily manipulated against charters. I think school choice is the way of the future. And I think it's what's best for our children. Because school choice gives the parents an option that simply wouldn't exist without it. For example, if a kid lives in a rundown neighborhood, that kid would be forced to attend a rundown school. So having school choice, even the Heritage Foundation said that education choice breaks the arbitrary link between the price of a home and the quality of the education that a child can attend to. So I just love, and I would, if I was in Sacramento, I would continue on that work that she did.
Akilah, you shook your head. I want to get at what you were shaking your head about.
Well, I just wanted to correct Marco. Dr. Shirley Weber was never against charter schools. She has always been for any school, whether it's a traditional public school or a public charter school that is showing you know, progress with all of their students, especially the Black and Brown students. So she has never taken a stance that was against charter. She's never taken a stance that was against traditional public schools. She's always been very, like you said, she's a great advocate for students, and she's always put them first and their academic achievement. So that's why I was shaking my head that she's never stated that she was against charter school.
So I saw that in the early days, her position was different and that it evolved after we saw the great success of Gumper School.
I mean, there are many, many good charter schools throughout our district. O'Farrell and La Mesa, we've got Helix. You know, so it's she's never had a stance that she was against charter schools. She's for any school that is, you know, doing well by all of its students and its teachers, and especially for their Black and Brown students.
Yeah, Erin Meek, I want to hear from you.
Although I'm very supportive of school choice, because different things work for different people. When we talk about equity versus equality, equity gives folks what they need. Equality just gives you a blanket. And we really need to address our educational system in a comprehensive way. And what I mean by that is I really, truly believe that when a charter school is not operating properly, we need to go ahead and shut them down, because that money can go somewhere else that is actually going to give our kids the right education. But I truly believe that school choice is huge, especially in the 79th district.
Shane, you perked up when the mention of O'Farrell Charter came up. What made you
I'm the bad school that's my school. Like, when people talk about failing schools and the bad teachers, that's, you're talking about me and my students. So it's interesting because I've been teaching at Bell for like 7 years now. And when a neighborhood school converts to a charter school, what happens is that neighborhood actually loses a fully public school. The kid across the street doesn't get to go to that school anymore. They have to apply to go to that school, and they don't necessarily get in. So when O'Farrell, Keeler, they basically don't have feeder patterns anymore. So kids either have to take a bus or go really far to leave their neighborhood to go to a neighborhood school. Or they have to apply to get in. Every year I always ask my students, who lives closer to O'Farrell? And hands will go up, and I'll ask, why don't you go there? Or Keeler, or wherever. And I'll ask, and they'll say, oh, well, my mom talked with the principal and they said Bell would be a better fit for me. And it's over and over, and it's English learners, kids with IEPs, kids with behavioral issues. And at the beginning, there's this date in October where school funding, you get funded for the rest of the year based on your enrollment. So after that October date, we have a new influx of kids that come in from a variety of charter schools around the county. So we get kids from the High Tech Highs, we get them from Preuss, and suddenly now they're with us, but that school gets to count them for their money for the rest of the year. And then at the semester, we have another influx of kids from charter schools who've been canceled out of their charter school. And we welcome them because we're actually a public school and we accept everybody. And
Scott,
then right
can
before
I respond
testing,
to that?
Yeah. And then right before testing, there's another influx of kids when the charter schools are dumping their kids because they don't want those test scores on their rosters.
Yeah,
so
Mark,
like I have the front row view to that. It's a good narrative, but when you get up close, it's a lot more complex and nuanced.
No, there's great evidence that shows that charter schools are actually great for students in the charter school, but also for the students in the public school. Listen to this. According to the Temple University study, when a charter school opens within 1 mile of a traditional public school, student outcomes within that traditional public school significantly increases in reading and math. Furthermore, the closer the charter school is located to the traditional public school, the better the academic outcomes are for students in the traditional public schools. And it's clear, is the competition, it only improves the environment for all the students.
Okay. Well, I'm really proud that we spent a lot of time on public education, and I know that you all care about it, and that's important. So thank you for spending that time. Thanks for listening to this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, including part two of this debate, which is dedicated to police and criminal justice. That one got a little heated. It was great. I appreciated everybody's comments and everybody who was watching who weighed in. That'll be out soon. And if you want to keep up with all of our assembly coverage and politics news, we've got newsletters for you. The Sacramento Report and the Politics Report come out every week. Get those at vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice San Diego. The show is produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you soon.